goes. He sucks in his deepest breath of the evening, lets it out, shakes his head, staring off over Hiro's shoulder. He takes a couple of nice long swigs from his glass of beer.
There was a Soviet nuclear missile submarine. The commander was named Ovchinnikov. He was religiously faithful, but he wasn't a fanatic like the Orthos. I mean, if he had been a fanatic, they wouldn't have given him command of a nuclear missile submarine, right? Supposedly. You had to be psychologically stable, whatever that means. Anyway, after things fell apart in Russia, he found himself in possession of this very dangerous weapon. He made up his mind that he was going to offload all of the crew and then scuttle it in the Marianas Trench, bury all those weapons forever. But somehow, he was persuaded to use this submarine to help a bunch of the Orthos escape to Alaska. They, and a lot of other refuse, had started flocking to the Bering coast. And the conditions in some of these refugee camps were pretty desperate. It's not like a lot of food can be grown in that area, you know. These people were dying by the thousands. They just stood on the beaches, starving to death, waiting for a ship to come. So Ovchinnikov let himself be persuaded to use his submarine, which is very large and very fast, to evacuate some of these poor refuse to Truk. But naturally he was paranoid about the idea of letting a whole bunch of unknown quantities onto his ship. These nuke subcommanders are real security freaks, for obvious reasons. So they set up a very strict system. All the refuse who were going to get on the ship had to pass through metal detectors, had to be inspected. Then they were under armed guard all the way across to Alaska. Well, the stern Orthos have this guy named Raven.
I'm familiar with him.
Well, Raven got onto that nuclear submarine.
Oh my God.
He got over to the Siberian coast somehow. Probably surfed across in his fucking kayak.
Surfed?
That's how the Aleuts get between islands.
Raven's an Aleut?
Yeah, an Aleut whale killer. You know what an Aleut is.
Yeah, my dad knew one in Japan, Hiro says. A bunch of Dad's old prison camp tales are beginning to stir in Hiro's memory, working their way up out of deep, deep storage.
The Aleuts just paddle out in their kayaks and catch a wave. They can outrun a steamship, you know?
Didn't know that.
Anyway, Raven went to one of these refugee camps and passed himself off as a Siberian tribesman. You can't tell some of those Siberians apart from our Indians. The Orthos apparently had some Confederates in these camps who bumped Raven up to the head of the line, so he got to be on the submarine.
But you said there was a metal detector.
Didn't help. He uses glass knives, chips them out of plate glass. It's the sharpest blade in the universe, you know?
Didn't know that either.
Yeah. The edge is only a single molecule wide. Doctors use them for eye surgery. They can cut your cornea and not leave a scar. There's Indians who make a living doing that, you know, chipping out eye scalpels.
Well, you learn something new every day. That kind of knife would be sharp enough to go through bulletproof fabric, I guess, Hiro says. Chuck writes and shrugs.
I lost track of the number of people Raven snuffed who were wearing bulletproof fabric.
Hiro says, I thought he must be carrying some kind of high-tech laser knife or something.
Think again. Glass knife. He had one on board the submarine. Either smuggled it on board with him or else found the chunk of glass on the submarine and chipped it out himself.
And?
Chuck gets his thousand-yard stare again, takes another slug of beer.
On a sub, you know, there's no place for things to drain to. The survivors claimed that the blood was knee-deep all through the submarine. Raven just killed everyone. Everyone except the Orthos, a skeleton crew, and some other refuse who were able to barricade themselves in little compartments around the ship. The survivors say,
Chuck says, taking another swig,
that it was quite a night.
And he forced them to steer the submarine into the hands of the Orthos.
To their anchorage off Kodiak, Chuck says. The Orthos were all ready. They had put together a crew of ex-Navy men, guys who had worked on nuke subs in the past. X-rays, they called them. And they came and took the sub over. As for us, we had no idea that any of this had happened. Until one of the warheads showed up in our goddamn front yard.
Chuck glances up above Hero's head, noticing someone. Hero feels a light tap on his shoulder.
"Excuse me, sir," a man is saying. "Pardon me for just a second."
Hero turns around. It's a big, porky white man with wavy, slicked-back red hair and a beard. He's got a baseball cap perched on top of his head, tilted way back to expose the following words tattooed in block letters across his forehead. Mood swings. Racially insensitive. Hero is looking up at all of this over the curving horizon of the man's flannel-clad belly.
"What is it?" Hero says.
"Well, sir, I'm sorry to disturb you in the middle of your conversation with this gentleman here, but me and my friends were just wondering, are you a lazy, shiftless, watermelon-eating black-ass nigger, or a sneaky little VD-infected gook?"
The man reaches up, pulls the brim of his baseball cap downward. Now Hero can see the Confederate flag printed on the front. The embroidered words, "New South Africa Franchulet number 153. Hero pushes himself up over the table, spins around, and slides backward on his ass toward Chuck, trying to get the table between him and the new South African. Chuck has conveniently vanished, so Hero ends up standing with his back comfortably to the wall, looking out over the bar. At the same time, a dozen or so other men are standing up from their tables, forming up behind the first one in a grinning, sunburned phalanx of Confederate flags and sideburns.
"Let's see," Hero says. "Is that some kind of a trick question?"
There are a lot of town halls and a lot of Snooze and Cruise franchises where you have to check your weapons at the entrance. This is not one of them. Hero isn't sure if that is bad or good. Without weapons, the new South Africans would just beat the crap out of him. With weapons, Hero can fight back, but the stakes are higher. Hero is bulletproof up to his neck, but that just means the new South Africans will all be going for a headshot. And they pride themselves on marksmanship. It is a fetish with them.
"Isn't there an NSA franchise down the road?" Hero says.
"Yeah,"
says the point man, who has a long, spreading body and short, stumpy legs.
"It's heaven. It really is. Ain't no place on earth like a new South Africa."
"Well, then, if you don't mind my asking," Hero says, "if it's so damn nice, why don't y'all go back to your egg sack and hang out there?"
"There's one problem with new South Africa," the guy says. "Don't mean to sound unpatriotic, but it's true."
"And what is that problem?" Hero says.
"There's no niggers, gooks, or kikes there to beat the shit out of."
"Ah, that is a problem," Hero says. "Thank you."
"For what?"
"For announcing your intentions. Giving me the right to do this."
Then Hero cuts his head off.
What else can he do?
There are at least 12 of them. They have made a point of blocking the only exit. They have just announced their intentions, and presumably they are all carrying heat. Besides, this kind of thing is going to happen to him about every 10 seconds when he's on the raft. The new South African has no idea what's coming, but he starts to react as Hero is swinging the katana at his neck, so he is flying backward when the decapitation occurs. That is good, because about half his blood supply comes lofting out the top of his neck. Twin jets, one from each carotid. Hero doesn't get a drop in himself. In the metaverse, the blade just passes right through if you swing it quickly enough. Here in reality, Hero's expecting a powerful shock when his blade hits the new South African's neck. Like when you hit a baseball the wrong way, but he hardly feels a thing. It just goes right through and almost swings around and buries itself in the wall. He must have gotten lucky and hit a gap between vertebrae. Hiro's training comes back to him, oddly. He forgot to squeeze it off, forgot to stop the blade himself, and that's bad form. Even though he's expecting it, he's startled for a minute. This sort of thing doesn't happen with avatars. They just fall down. For an astonishingly long time, he just stands there and looks at the guy's body. Meanwhile, the airborne cloud of blood is seeking its level, dripping from the hung ceiling, spattering down from shelves behind the bar. A wino sitting there nursing a double shot of vodka shakes and shivers, staring into his glass at the galactic swirl of a trillion red cells dying in the ethanol. Hiro swaps a few long glances with the new South Africans, like everyone in the bar is trying to come to a consensus as to what will happen next. Should they laugh, take a picture, run away, call an ambulance? He makes his way around toward the exit by running across people's tables. It is rude, but other patrons scoot back. Some of them are quick enough to snatch their beers out of his way, and no one gives him any hassles. The sight of the bear katana inspires everyone to a practically Nipponese level of politeness. There are a couple more new South Africans blocking Hiro's way out, but not because they want to stop anyone. It's just where they happen to be standing when they go into shock. Hiro decides, reflexively, not to kill them. And Hiro is off into the lurid main avenue of the town hall, a tunnel of flickering and pulsating low-glow, through which black creatures sprint like benighted sperm up the old fallopians, sharp angular things clenched in their hands. They are the enforcers. They make the average metacop look like Ranger Rick. Gargoyle time. Hiro switches everything on. Infrared, millimeter wave radar, ambient sound processing. The infrared doesn't do much in these circumstances, but the radar picks out all the weapons, highlights them in the enforcer's hands, identifies them by make, model, and ammunition type. They're all fully automatic. But the enforcers and the new South Africans don't need radar to see Hiro's katana, with blood and spinal fluid running down the blade. The music of Vitali Chernobyl and the Meltdowns is blasting through bad speakers all around him. It is their first single to hit the Billboard charts, entitled My Heart is a Smoking Hole in the Ground. The ambient sound processing cuts it to a more reasonable level, evens out the nasty distortion from the speakers so that he can hear his roommate singing more clearly, which makes it all particularly surreal. It just goes to show that he's out of his element, doesn't belong here, lost in the biomass. If there was any justice, he could jump into those speakers and trace up the wires like a digital sylph, follow the grid back to L.A. where he belongs, there on top of the world, where everything comes from, buy Vitali a drink, crawl into his futon. He stumbles forward helplessly as something terrible happens to his back. It feels like being massaged with 100 ball-peen hammers. At the same time, a yellow sputtering light overrides the low glow. A screaming red display flashes up on the goggles, informing him that the millimeter wave radar has noticed a stream of bullets headed in his direction, and would you like to know where they came from, sir? Hiro has just been shot in the back with a burst of machine gun fire. All of the bullets have slapped into his vest and dropped to the floor, but in doing so, they have cracked about half of the ribs on that side of his body and bruised a few internal organs. He turns around, which hurts. The enforcer has given up on bullets and whipped out another weapon. It says so right on Hero's goggles. Pacific Enforcement Hardware, Inc. Model SX-29. Restraint projection device. Loogie gun. Which is what he should have used in the first place. You can't just carry a sword around as an empty threat. You shouldn't draw it or keep it drawn unless you intend to kill someone. Hiro runs toward the enforcer, raising the katana to strike. The enforcer does the proper thing, namely, gets the hell out of his way. The silver ribbon of the katana shines up above the crowd. It attracts enforcers and repels everyone else. So as Hiro runs down the center of the town hall, he has no one in front of him and many shiny dark creatures behind him. He turns off all of the techno shit in his goggles. All it does is confuse him.
He stands there, reading statistics about his own death, even as it's happening to him. Very postmodern. Time to get immersed in reality like all the people around him. Not even enforcers will fire their big guns in a crowd, unless it's point-blank range, or they're in a really bad mood. A few loogies shoot past Hero, already so spread out as to be nothing more than an annoyance, and splat into bystanders, wrapping them in sticky gossamer veils. Somewhere between the 3D video game arcade and the display window full of terminally bored prostitutes, Hero's eyes clear up and he sees a miracle. The exit of the inflatable dome, where the doors exhale a breeze of synthetic beer breath and atomized body fluids into the cool night air. Bad things and good things are happening in quick succession. The next bad thing happens when a steel grate falls down to block the doors. What the hell? It's an inflatable building. Hero turns on the radar just for a moment, and the walls seem to drop away and become invisible. He's seeing through them now, into the forest of steel outside. It doesn't take long to locate the parking lot where he left his bike, supposedly under the protection of some armed attendants. Hero fakes toward the whorehouse, then cuts directly toward an exposed section of wall. The fabric of the building is tough, but his katana slices a 6-foot rent through it with a single gliding motion, and then he's outside, spat out of the hole on a jet of fetid air. After that, after Hero gets onto his motorcycle, and the new South Africans get into their all-terrain pickups, and the enforcers get into their slick black enforcer mobiles, and they all go screaming out into the highway, after that, it's just the chase scene. YT has been to some unusual places in her career. She has the visas of some 3 dozen countries laminated onto her chest. And on top of the real countries, she has picked up and or delivered to such charming little vacation spots as the Terminal Island Sacrifice Zone and the encampment in Griffith Park. But the weirdest job of all is this new one. Someone wants her to deliver some stuff to the United States of America. Says so right there in the job order. It's not much of a delivery, just a legal size envelope. You sure you don't just want to mail this? She asks the guy when she picks it up. It's one of these creepy office parks out in the burbs, like a burbclave for worthless businesses that have offices and phones and stuff but don't actually seem to do anything. It's a sarcastic question, of course. The mail doesn't work except in Fedland. All the mailboxes have been unbolted and used to decorate the apartments of nostalgia freaks. But it's also kind of a joke because the destination is, in fact, a building in the middle of Fedland. So the joke is, if you want to deal with the feds, why not use their fucked up mail system? Aren't you afraid that by dealing with anything as incredibly cool as a courier, you will be tainted in their eyes? Well, the mail doesn't come out here, does it? The guy says. No point in describing the office. No point in even allowing the office to even register on her eyeballs and take up valuable memory space in her brain. Fluorescent lights and partitions with carpet glued to them. I prefer my carpet on the floor, thank you. A color scheme, ergonomic shit. Chicks with lipstick, Xerox smell. Everything's pretty new, she figures. The legal envelope is resting on the guy's desk. Not much point in describing him, either. Traces of a Southern or Texan accent. The bottom edge of the envelope is parallel to the edge of the desk, 1/4 inch away from it, perfectly centered between the left and right sides. Like he had a doctor come in here and put it on the desk with tweezers. It is addressed to Room 968A, Mail Stop MS-1569835, Building LA-6, United States of America. You want a return address on this? She says. That's not necessary. If I can't deliver it, there's no way I can get it back to you, because these places all look the same to me. It's not important, he says. When do you think you'll get it there? 2 hours, max. Why so long? Customs, man.
The feds haven't modernized their system like everyone else, which is why most couriers will do anything to avoid delivering to Fedland. But it's a slow day today. YT hasn't been called in to do any secret missions for the Mafia yet, and maybe she can catch Mom on her lunch break. And your name is? We don't give out our names. I need to know who's delivering this. Why? You said it wasn't important. The guy gets really flustered. Okay, he says. Forget it. Just deliver it, please. Okay, be that way, she mentally says. She mentally says a number of other things, too. The man is an obvious pervert. It's so plain, so open. And your name is? Give me a break, man. Names are unimportant. Everyone knows couriers are interchangeable parts. It's just that some happen to be a lot faster and better. So she skates out of the office. It's all very anonymous. No corporate logos anywhere. So as she's waiting for the elevator, she calls Radicais, tries to find out who initiated this call. The answer comes back a few minutes later as she's riding out of the office park, pooned onto a nice Mercedes. Rife Advanced Research Enterprises. Rare. One of these high-tech outfits. Probably trying to get a government contract. Probably trying to sell Sphygmo manometers to the feds or something like that. Oh well, she just delivers them. She gets the impression that this Mercedes is sandbagging, driving real slow so she'll poon something else. So she poons something else, an outgoing delivery truck. Judging from the way it's riding high in its springs, it must be empty, so it'll probably move along pretty fast. 10 seconds later, predictably, the Mercedes blasts by in the left lane, so she poons that and rides it nice and hard for a couple of miles. Getting into Fedland is a drag. Most Fedsters drive tiny plastic and aluminum cars that are hard to poon. But eventually she nails one, a little jelly bean with glued-on windows and a 3-cylinder engine, and that takes her up to the United States border. The smaller this country gets, the more paranoid they become. Nowadays, the customs people are just impossible. She has to sign a 10-page document, and they actually make her read it. They say it should take at least half an hour for her just to read the thing. But I read it 2 weeks ago.
It might have changed, the guard says. So you have to read it again.
Basically, it just certifies that YT is not a terrorist, communist, whatever that is, homosexual, national symbol desecrator, pornography merchant, welfare parasite, racially insensitive, carrier of any infectious disease, or advocate of any ideology tending to impugn traditional family values. Most of it is just definitions of all the words used on the first page. So YT sits in the little room for half an hour doing housekeeping work, going over her stuff, changing batteries in all her little devices, cleaning her nails, having her skateboard run its self-maintenance procedures. Then she signs the fucking document and hands it over to the guy. And then she's in Fedland. It's not hard finding the place. Typical Fed building. A million steps. Like it's built on top of a mountain of steps. Columns. A lot more guys in this one than usual. Chunky guys with slippery hair. Must be some kind of cop building. The guard at the front door is a cop all the way, wants to give her a big hassle about carrying her skateboard into the place. Like they've got a safe place out front to keep skateboards. The cop guy is completely hard to deal with. But that's okay. So is YT. Here's the envelope, she says. You can take it up to the 9th floor yourself on your coffee break. Too bad you have to take the stairs.
Look, he says, totally exasperated. This is EBGOC. This is like the headquarters. EBGOC Central, you got that? Everything that happens within a mile is being videotaped. People don't spit on the pavement within sight of this building. They don't even say bad words. Nobody's going to steal your skateboard.
That's even worse. They'll steal it. And then they'll say they didn't steal it, they confiscated it. I know you, Feds, you're always confiscating shit. The guy sighs. Then his eyes go out of focus and he shuts up for a minute. YT can tell he's getting a message over the little earphone that's plugged into his ear, the mark of the true Fed.
Go on in, he says. But you gotta sign.
Naturally, YT says. The cop hands her the sign-in sheet, which is actually a notebook computer with an electronic pen. She writes YT on the screen. It's converted to a digital bitmap, automatically time-stamped, and sent off to the big computer at Fed Central. She knows she's not going to make it through the metal detector without stripping naked. So she just vaults the cop's table. What's he going to do, shoot her? And heads on into the building, skateboard under her arm.
Hey!
He says, weakly.
What? You got lots of EBGOC agents in here being mugged and raped by female couriers?
She says, stomping the elevator button ferociously. Elevator takes forever. She loses her patience and just climbs the stairs like all the other feds. The guy is right. It's definitely Cop Central here on the 9th floor. Every creepy guy in sunglasses and slippery hair you've ever seen, they're all here, all with little flesh-toned helices of wire trailing down from their ears. There's even some female feds. They look even scarier than the guys. The things that a woman can do to her hair to make herself look professional? Jesus! Why not just wear a motorcycle helmet? At least then you can take it off. Except none of the feds, male or female, is wearing sunglasses. They look naked without them. Might as well be walking around with no pants on. Seeing these feds without their mirror specs is like blundering into the boys' locker room. She finds room 968A easily enough. Most of the floor is just a big pool of desks. All the actual numbered rooms are around the edges with frosted glass doors. Each of the creepy guys seems to have a desk of his own. Some of them loiter near their desks. The rest of them are doing a lot of hall jogging and impromptu conferencing at other creepy guys' desks. Their white shirts are painfully clean. Not as many shoulder holsters as she would expect. All the gun-carrying feds are probably out in what used to be Alabama or Chicago, trying to confiscate back bits of United States territory from what is now a buy-and-fly or a toxic waste dump. She goes on into room 968A. It's an office. 4 fed guys are in here, the same as the others, except most of them are a tad older, in their 40s and 50s.
Got a delivery for this room, YT says.
You're YT, says the head fed, who's sitting behind the desk.
You're not supposed to know my name, YT says. How did you know my name?
I recognized you, the head fed says. I know your mother.
YT does not believe him. But these feds have all kinds of ways of finding out stuff. Do you have any relatives in Afghanistan? She says. The guys all look back and forth at each other. Like, did you understand the chick? But it's not a sentence that is intended to be understood. Actually, YT has all kinds of voice recognition wear in her coverall and in her plank. When she says, do you have any relatives in Afghanistan? That's like a code phrase. It tells all of her spook gear to get ready, shake itself down, check itself out, prick up its electronic ears. You want this envelope or not? She says.
I'll take it, the head fed says,
standing up and holding out one hand. YT walks into the middle of the room and hands him the envelope. But instead of taking it, he lunges out at the last minute and grabs her forearm. She sees an open handcuff in his other hand. He brings it out and snaps it down on her wrist so it tightens and locks shut over the cuff of her coverall.
I'm sorry to do this, YT, but I have to place you under arrest, he's saying.
What the fuck are you doing? YT is saying. She's holding her free arm back away from the desk so he can't cuff her wrists together, but one of the other feds grabs her by the free wrist, so now she's stretched out like a tightrope between the two big feds. You guys are dead, she says. All the guys smile, like they enjoy a chick with some spunk. You guys are dead, she says a second time. This is the key phrase that all of her wear is waiting to hear. When she says it the second time, all the self-defense stuff comes on, which means that, among other things, a few thousand volts of radio frequency electrical power suddenly flood through the outsides of her cuffs. The head fed behind the desk blurts out a grunt from way down in his stomach. He flies back away from her, his entire right side jerking spastically, trips over his own chair, and sprawls back into the wall, smacking his head on the marble windowsill. The jerk who's yanking on her other arm stretches out like he's on an invisible rack, accidentally slapping one of the other guys in the face, giving that guy a nice dose of juice to the head. Both of them hit the floor like a sack of rabid cats. There's only one of these guys left, and he's reaching under his jacket for something. She takes one step toward him, swings her arm around, and the end of the loose manacle strokes him in the neck. Just a caress, but it might as well be a two-handed blow from Satan's electric axe handle. That funky juice runs all up and down his spine, and suddenly he's sprawled across a couple of shitty old wooden chairs, and his pistol is rotating on the floor like the spinner in a children's game. She flexes her wrist in a particular way, and the Bundy stunner drops down her sleeve and into her hand. The manacle swinging from the other hand will have a similar effect on that side. She also pulls out the can of liquid knuckles, pops the lid, sets the spray nozzle on wide angle. One of the Fed creeps is nice enough to open the office door for her. He comes into the room with his gun already drawn, backed up by half a dozen other guys who flocked here from the office pool, and she just lets them have it with the liquid knuckles. Whoosh! It's like bug spray. The sound of bodies hitting the floor is like a bass drum roll. She finds that her skateboard has no problem rolling across their prone bodies, and then she's out into the office pool. These guys are converging from all sides. There's an incredible number of them. She just keeps holding that button down, pointed straight ahead, digging at the floor with her foot, building up speed. The liquid knuckles acts like a chemical flying wedge. She's skating out of there on a carpet of bodies. Some of the feds are agile enough to dart in from behind and try to get her that way. But she's ready with the Bundy stunner, which turns their nervous systems into coils of hot barbed wire for a few minutes, but isn't supposed to have any other effects. She's made it about three-quarters of the way across the office when the liquid knuckles runs out. But it still works for a second or two because people are afraid of it, keep diving out of the way even though there's nothing coming out. Then a couple of them figure it out, make the mistake of trying to grab her by the wrists. She gets one of them with the Bundy stunner and the other with the electric manacle. Then boom through the door and she's out into the stairwell, leaving four dozen casualties in her wake. Serves them right. They didn't even try to arrest her in a gentlemanly way. To a man on foot, stairs are a hindrance. But to the smart wheels, they just look like a 45-degree angle ramp. It's a little choppy, especially when she's down to about the second floor and is going way too fast, but it's definitely doable. A lucky thing. One of the first floor cops is just opening the stairwell door, no doubt alerted by the symphony of alarm bells and buzzers that has begun to merge into a solid wall of hysterical sound. She blows by the guy. He puts one arm out in an attempt to stop her, sort of belts her across the waist in the process, throws her balance off. But this is a very forgiving skateboard. It's smart enough to slow down for her a little bit when her center of mass gets into the wrong place. Pretty soon it's back under her. She's banking radically through the elevator lobby, aiming dead center for the arch of the metal detector, through which the bright outdoor light of freedom is shining. Her old buddy the cop is up on his feet, and he reacts fast enough to spread eagle himself across the metal detector. Whitey acts like she's heading right for him, then kicks the board sideways at the last minute, punches one of the toe switches, coils her legs underneath her, and jumps into the air. She flies right over his little table while the plank is rolling underneath it, and a second later she lands on it, wobbles once, gets her balance back. She's in the lobby, headed for the doors. It's an old building. Most of the doors are metal. But there's a couple of revolving doors, too, just big sheets of glass. Early thrashers used to inadvertently skate into walls of glass from time to time, which was a problem. It turned into a bigger problem when the whole courier thing got started, and thrashers started spending a lot more time trying to go fast through office-type environments where glass walls are considered quite the concept. which is why on an expensive skateboard like this one definitely is, you can get, as an extra added safety feature, the Radicae S Narrow Cone Tuned Shockwave Projector. It works on real short notice, which is good, but you can only use it once. It draws its power from an explosive charge, and then you have to take your plank into the shop to have it replaced. It's an emergency thing, strictly a panic button. But that's cool. YT makes sure she's aimed directly at the glass revolving doors, then hits the appropriate toe switch. It's, my God, like you stretched a tarp across a stadium to turn it into a giant tom-tom and then crashed a 747 into it. She can feel her internal organs move several inches. Her heart trades places with her liver. The bottoms of her feet feel numb and tingly. And she's not even standing in the path of the shockwave. The safety glass in the revolving doors doesn't just crack and fall to the floor like she imagined it would. It is blown out of its moorings. It gushes out of the building and down the front steps. She follows an instant later. The ridiculous cascade of white marble steps in the front of the building just gives her more ramp time. By the time she reaches the sidewalk, she's easily got enough speed to coast all the way to Mexico. As she's swinging out across the broad avenue, aiming her crosshairs at the customs post a quarter mile away, which she is going to have to jump over, something tells her to look up. Because, after all, the building she just escaped from is towering above her, many stories full of Fed creeps, and all the alarms are going off. Most of the windows can't be opened, all they can do is look out. But there are people on the roof. Mostly, the roof is a forest of antennas. If it's a forest, these guys are the creepy little gnomes who live in the trees. They are ready for action. They have their sunglasses on. They have weapons. They're all looking at her. But only one guy's taking aim. And the thing he's aiming at her is huge. The barrel is the size of a baseball bat. She can see the muzzle flash poke out of it, wreathed in a sudden donut of white smoke. It's not pointed right at her. It's aimed in front of her. The stun bunny lands on the street dead ahead, bounces up in the air, and detonates at an altitude of 20 feet. The next quarter of a second. There's no bright flash to blind her, and so she can actually see the shockwave spreading outward in a perfect sphere, hard and palpable as a ball of ice. Where the sphere contacts the street, it makes a circular wave front, making pebbles bounce, flipping old McDonald's containers that have long been smashed flat, and coaxing fine flower-like dust out of all the tiny crevices in the pavement so that it sweeps across the road toward her like a microscopic blizzard. Above it, the shockwave hangs in the air, rushing toward her at the speed of sound, a lens of air that flattens and refracts everything on the other side. She's passing through it. As Hiro crests the pass on his motorcycle at 5 in the morning, the town of Port Sherman, Oregon, is suddenly laid out before him. A flash of yellow low glow wrapped into a vast U-shaped valley that was ground out of the rock a long time ago by a big tongue of ice in an epical period of geological cunnilingus. There is just a light dusting of gold around the edges where it fades into the rainforest, thickening and intensifying as it approaches the harbor. A long, narrow fjord-like notch cut into the straight coastline of Oregon, a deep, cold trench of black water heading straight out to Japan. Hiro's back on the rim again. Feels good after that night ride through the sticks. Too many rednecks. Too many Mounties. Even from 10 miles away and a mile above, it's not a pretty sight. Farther away from the Central Harbor District, Hiro can make out a few speckles of red, which is a little better than the yellow. He wishes he could see something in green or blue or purple, but there don't seem to be any neighborhoods done up in those gourmet colors. But then, this isn't exactly a gourmet job. He rides half a mile off the road, sits down on a flat rock in an open space, ambush-proof, more or less, and goggles into the metaverse.
Librarian?
Yes, sir.
Inanna. A figure from Sumerian mythology. Later cultures knew her as Ishtar or Esther.
Good goddess or bad goddess?
Good. A beloved goddess.
Did she have any dealings with Enki or Asherah?
Mostly with Enki. She and Enki were on good and bad terms at different times. Inanna was known as the queen of all the great Mei.
I thought the Mei belonged to Enki.
They did, but Inanna went to the Abzu, the watery fortress in the city of Eridu, where Enki stored up the Mei, and got Enki to give her all the Mei. This is how the Mei were released into civilization.
Watery fortress, huh?
Yes, sir.
How did Enki feel about this?
He gave them to her willingly, apparently because he was drunk and besotted with Inanna's physical charms. When he sobered up, he tried to chase her down and get them back, but she outsmarted him.
Let's get semiotic, Hero mumbles. The raft is Elbob Rife's watery fortress. That's where he stores up all of his stuff, all of his Mei. Juanita went to Astoria, which was as close as you can get to the raft a couple of days ago. I think she's trying to pull an Inanna.
In another popular Sumerian myth, the librarian says, Inanna descends into the netherworld.
Go on, Hero says.
She gathers together all of her Mei and enters the land of no return.
Great.
She passes through the netherworld and reaches the temple that is ruled over by Ereshkigal, goddess of death. She is traveling under false pretenses, which are easily penetrated by the all-seeing Ereshkigal. But Ereshkigal allows her to enter the temple. As Inanna enters, her robes and jewels and Mei are stripped from her, and she is brought stark naked before Ereshkigal and the seven judges of the underworld. The judges, quote, fasten their eyes upon her, the eyes of death. At their word, the word which tortures the spirit, Inanna was turned into a corpse, a piece of rotting meat, and was hung from a hook on the wall. End quote. Kramer.
Wonderful. Why the hell would she do something like that?
As Diane Wolkstein puts it, quote, Inanna gave up all she had accomplished in life until she was stripped naked with nothing remaining but her will to be reborn. Because of her journey to the underworld, she took on the powers and mysteries of death and rebirth. End quote.
Oh, so I guess there's more to the story.
Inanna's messenger waits for 3 days, and when she fails to return from the netherworld, goes to the gods asking for their help. None of the gods is willing to help, except for Enki.
So our buddy Enki, the hacker god, has to bail her ass out of hell.
Enki creates 2 people and sends them into the netherworld to rescue Inanna. Through their magic, Inanna is brought back to life. She returns from the netherworld, followed by a host of the dead.
Juanita went to the raft 3 days ago, Hero says. It's time to get hacking.
Earth is still where he left it, zoomed in to show a magnified view of the raft. In the light of last night's chat with Chuck Wrightson, it's not hard to find the hunk of raft that was staked out by the Orthos when the Enterprise swung by truck a few weeks back. There's a couple of big-ass Soviet freighters tied together, a swarm of small boats around them. Most of the raft is dead brown and organic, but this section is all white fiberglass, pleasure craft looted from the comfortable retirees of Trock. Thousands of them. Now the raft is off Port Sherman, so Hero figures that's where the high priests of Asherah are hanging out. In a few days, they'll be in Eureka, then San Francisco, then L.A., a floating land link tying the Ortho's operations on the raft to the closest available point on the mainland. He turns away from the raft, skims across the ocean to Port Sherman to do a bit of reconnoitering there. Down along the waterfront, there's a nice crescent of cheap motels with yellow logos. Hero rifles through them, looking for Russian names. That's easy. There's a Spectrum 2000 right in the middle of the waterfront. As the name implies, each one has a whole range of rooms, from human coin lockers in the lobby all the way to luxury suites on the top. And a whole range of rooms has been rented out by a bunch of people with names ending in Off and Ovsky and other dead Slavic giveaways. The foot soldiers sleep in the lobby, laid out straight and narrow in coin lockers next to their AK-47s, and the priests and generals live in nice rooms higher up. Hero pauses to wonder what a Pentecostal Russian Orthodox priest does with the magic fingers. The suite on the very top is being rented out by a gentleman by the name of Gurov. Mr. KGB himself. Too much of a wimp to hang out on the actual raft, apparently. How'd he get from the raft to Port Sherman? If it involves crossing a couple of hundred miles of North Pacific, it must be a decent-sized vessel. There are a half a dozen marinas in Port Sherman. At the moment, most of them are clogged with small brown boats. It looks like a post-typhoon situation, where a few hundred square miles of ocean have been swept clean of sampans that have piled up against the nearest hard place. Except, this is slightly more organized than that. The refuse are coming ashore already. If they're smart and aggressive, they probably know that they can walk to California from here. That explains why the piers are clogged with trashy little boats. But one of them still looks like a private marina. It's got a dozen or so clean white vessels lined up neatly in their slips, no riffraff. And the resolution of this image is good enough that Hero can see the pier speckled with little donuts, probably rings of sandbags. That'd be the only way to keep your private moorage private when the raft was hovering offshore. The numbers, flags, and other identifying goodies are harder to make out. The satellite has a hard time picking that stuff out. Hero checks to see whether CIC has a stringer in Port Sherman. They have to because the raft is here, and CIC hopes to make a big business out of selling raft intelligence to all the anxious waterfronters between Skagway and Tierra del Fuego. Indeed, there are a few people hanging out in this town, uploading the latest Port Sherman intel. And one of them is just a punter with a video camera who goes around shooting pictures of everything. Hero reviews this stuff and fast forward. A lot of it is shot from the Stringer's hotel window. Hours and hours of coverage of the stream of shitty little brown boats laboring their way up the harbor, tying up to the edge of the mini-raft that's forming in front of Port Sherman. But it's semi-organized in that some apparently self-appointed water cops are buzzing around in a speedboat, aiming guns at people, shouting through a megaphone. And that explains why, no matter how tangled the mess in the harbor becomes, there's always a clear lane down the middle of the fjord headed out to sea. And the terminus of that clear lane is the nice pier with the big boats. There are two big vessels there. One is a large fishing boat flying a flag bearing the emblem of the Orthos, which is just a cross and a flame. It is obvious troc loot. The name on the stern is Kodiak Queen, and the Orthos haven't bothered to change it yet. The other large boat is a small cruise vessel made to carry rich people comfortably to nice places. It has a green flag and appears to be connected with Mr. Lee's Greater Hong Kong. Hero does a little more poking around in the streets of Port Sherman and finds out that there is a pretty good-sized Mr. Lee's Greater Hong Kong franchise here. In typical Hong Kong style, it is more of a spray of small buildings and rooms all over town. But it's a dense spray. Dense enough that Hong Kong has several full-time employees here, including a pro consul. Hero pulls up the guy's picture so he'll recognize him. A crusty-looking Chinese-American gent in his 50s. So it's not an automated, unmanned franchise like you normally see in the lower 48. 43. When she first woke up, she was still in her Radicaea's coverall,
mummified in gaffer's tape, lying on the floor of a shitty old Ford van blasting across the middle of nowhere. This did not put her in a very favorable mood. The stun bunny left her with a persistent nosebleed and an eternal throbbing headache, and every time the van hit a chuck hole, her head bounced on the corrugated steel floor. First, she was just pissed. Then she started having brief moments of fear, wanting to go home. After 8 hours in the back of the van, there was no doubt in her mind that she wanted to go home. The only thing that kept her from giving up was curiosity. As far as she could tell from this admittedly poor vantage point, this didn't look like a Fed operation. The van pulled off the highway onto a frontage road and into a parking lot. The rear doors of the van opened up, and a couple of women climbed in. Through the open doors, YT could see the Gothic Arch logo of a Reverend Wayne's pearly gates.
"Oh, you poor baby," one of the women said.
The other woman just gasped in horror at her condition. One of them just cradled her head and stroked her hair, letting her sip sweet Kool-Aid from a Dixie cup, while the other tenderly, slowly took the gaffer's tape off. Her shoes had already been removed when she woke up in the back of the van, and no one offered her another pair. And everything had been removed from her coverall. All the good stuff was gone. But they hadn't gone underneath the coverall. She still had the dog tags. And one other thing. A thing between her legs called a dentata. There's no way they could have found that. She has always known that the dog tags were probably a fake thing anyway. Uncle Enzo doesn't just go around giving his war souvenirs to 15-year-old chicks, but they still might have an effect on someone. The two women are named Marla and Bonnie. They are with her all the time. Not only with her, but touching her. Lots of hugs, squeezes, hand-holding, and tousled hair. The first time she goes to the bathroom, Bonnie goes with her, opening the stall door and actually standing in there with her. YT thinks that Bonnie is worried that she's going to pass out on the toilet or something. But the next time she has to pee, Marla goes with her. She gets no privacy at all. The only problem is, she can't deny that she likes it in a way. The ride in the van hurt. It really hurt bad. She never felt so lonely in her life. And now she's barefoot and defenseless in an unfamiliar place, and they're giving her what she needs. After she had a few minutes to freshen up, whatever that means, inside the Reverend Wayne's pearly gates, she and Marla and Bonnie climbed into a big stretch van with no windows. The floor was carpeted, but there were no seats inside. Everyone sat on the floor. The van was jammed when they opened the rear doors. 20 people were packed into it, all energetic, beaming youths. It looked impossible. YT shrank away from it, backing right into Marla and Bonnie. But a cheerful roar came up from the van people, white teeth flashing in the dimness, and people began to scrunch out a tiny space for them. She spent most of the next 2 days packed into the van between Bonnie and Marla, holding hands with them constantly, so she couldn't even pick her nose without permission. They sang happy songs until her brain turned to tapioca. They played wacky games. A couple of times every hour, someone in the van would start to babble, just like the Falabellas, just like the Reverend Wayne's Pearly Gates people. The babbling would spread throughout the van like a contagious disease, and soon everyone would be doing it. Everyone except for YT. She couldn't seem to get the hang of it. It just seemed embarrassingly stupid to her, so she just faked it. 3 times a day they had a chance to eat and eliminate. It always happened in burbclaves. YT could feel them pulling off the interstate, finding their way down twisty development lanes, courts, ways, and circles. A garage door would rise electrically. The van would pull in, the door would shut behind them. They would go into a suburban house, except stripped of furniture and other family touches, and sit on the floor in empty bedrooms, one for boys, one for girls, and eat cake and cookies. This always happened in a totally empty room in a house, but there was always different decor. In one place, flowery, countryish wallpaper and a lingering smell of rancid glade. In another, bluish wallpaper featuring hockey players, football players, basketball players. In another, just plain white walls with old crayon marks on them. Sitting in these empty rooms, YT would study the old furniture scrapes on the floors, the dents in the sheetrock, and muse over them like an archaeologist, wondering about the long-departed families who had once lived here. But toward the end of the ride, she wasn't paying attention anymore. In the van, she could hear nothing but singing and chanting, see nothing but the jammed-together faces of her companions. When they stopped for gas, they did it in giant truck stops out in the middle of nowhere, pulling up to the most distant pump island so that no one was near them. And they never stopped driving. They just got relayed from one driver to the next. Finally, they got to a coast. YT could smell it. They spent a few minutes waiting, engine idling, and then the van bumped over some kind of a threshold, climbed a few ramps, stopped, set its parking brake. The driver got out and left them all alone in the van for the first time. YT felt glad that the trip was over. Then everything started to rumble, like an engine noise, but a lot bigger. She didn't feel any movement until a few minutes later when she realized that everything was rocking gently. The van was parked on a ship, and the ship was headed out to sea. It's a real ocean-going ship. An old, shitty, rusty one that probably cost about $5 the ship junkyard. But it carries cars, and it goes through the water, and it doesn't sink. The ship is just like the van, except bigger, with more people. But they eat the same stuff, sing the same songs, and sleep just as rarely as ever. By now, YT finds it perversely comforting. She knows that she's with a lot of other people like her, and that she's safe. She knows the routine. She knows where she belongs. And so finally they come to the raft. No one has told YT this is where they're going, but by now it's obvious. She ought to be scared, but they wouldn't be going to the raft if it was as bad as everyone says. When it starts coming into view, she half expects them to converge on her with gaffer's tape again. But then she figures out it's not necessary. She hasn't been causing trouble. She's been accepted here. They trust her. It gives her a feeling of pride, in a way. And she won't cause trouble on the raft because all she can do is escape from their part of it onto the raft per se. As such, the real raft. The raft of 100 Hong Kong B-movies and blood-soaked Nipponese comic books. It doesn't take much imagination to think of what happens to lone 15-year-old blonde American girls on the raft, and these people know it. Sometimes she worries about her mother. Then she hardens her heart and thinks maybe the whole thing will be good for her. Shake her up a little. Which is what she needs. After Dad left, she just folded up into herself like an origami bird thrown into a fire. There is kind of an outer cloud of small boats surrounding the raft for a distance of a few miles. Almost all of them are fishing boats. Some of them carry men with guns, but they don't fuck around with this ferry. The ferry swings through this outer zone, making a broad turn, finally zeroing in on a white neighborhood on one flank of the raft. Literally white. All the boats here are clean and new. There's a couple of big rusty boats with Russian lettering on the side, and the ferry pulls up alongside one of them. Ropes are thrown across, then augmented with nets, gangplanks, webs of old discarded tires. This raft thing does not look like good skating territory at all. She wonders if any of the other people on board this ferry are skaters. Doesn't seem likely. Really, they are not her kind of people at all. She has always been a dirty scumdog of the highways, not one of these happy sing-along types. Maybe the raft is just the place for her. They take her down into one of the Russian ships and give her the grossest job of all time, cutting up fish. She does not want a job, has not asked for one, but that's what she gets. Still, no one really talks to her, no one bothers to explain anything, and that makes her reluctant to ask. She has just run into a massive cultural shockwave, because most of the people on this ship are old and fat and Russian and don't speak English. For a couple of days, she spends a lot of time sleeping on the job, being prodded awake by the hefty Russian dames who work in this place. She also does some eating. Some of the fish that comes through this place looks pretty rank, but there's a fair amount of salmon. The only way she knows this is from having sushi at the mall. Salmon is the orange-red stuff. So she makes some sushi of her own, munches down on some fresh salmon meat, and it's good. It clears her head a little. Once she gets over the shock of it and settles into a routine, she starts looking around her, watching the other fish-cutting dames, and realizes that this is just like life.